So at last we begin Isaiah. As you can see by what's in front of you there, Isaiah himself, that's Isaiah ben Amoz, is only mentioned in the first 39 chapters of the scroll. The rest of the Isaiah scroll has nothing particularly to do with Isaiah. It's a convenient place where later material, we will study it, has been added into the scroll. So we're talking about a particular person who lived in the second half of the 8th century BC. He lived in Jerusalem, and he's speaking, prophesying against a particular background. Reminding you of what I said a moment ago, references to the prophet Isaiah are found only in these chapters. Other parts were updated years later. Even within Isaiah chapter 1 to 39, there's material that probably comes from after the exile, during the exile, right through. So we've got to keep that in mind as we study it. And I quote again Joseph Blenkinsop, who says, he speaks of an Isaiah tradition carried forward by means of a cumulative process of reinterpretations and reapplication. And he goes on to say, the book has undergone successive restructuring and rearrangements in the course of a long editorial history. The background to the second half of the 8th century, that map, it's a bit small, but I hope I can guide you through it. It was a period of the expansion of the Assyrian Empire. We would call it northern Iraq. So that's Ashur, Nineveh, the capital. And the Assyrians were moving westward during this whole period. They will, halfway through Isaiah's period, they'll destroy and capture the whole of the north, whole of Israel. They'll go right down here, they'll attack Egypt. And at the end of his life, they actually destroy Judah, except Jerusalem was left intact because they paid a heavy tribute to the king of Assyria, and he wasn't that interested in capturing Jerusalem anyhow. So that's the political background of everything we're going to read. The main king of this period in Jerusalem was Hezekiah. That's during at least the second part of the prophecy period of Isaiah. It was during the reign of Hezekiah in Judah. Now, all the datings here are very tricky and very complex. But it looks like Hezekiah became king in 727 BC, but he was only a young boy. So he couldn't take over till he was 18 or so, and he became actual king some years later. The Assyrian army captured Samaria in 721 BC. That's Israel. Refugees from the northern kingdom of Israel poured into Jerusalem. So that's another phenomenon that's happening during this period of this prophet. And they had to expand Jerusalem from the hill across to the west and take over that western hill. Here are a couple of statements by two Jewish, one is an archaeologist, Finkelstein, and the other is a Jewish historian, Silbermann. And they've written extensively on this, and this is one of the results of their archaeological studies and historical studies, and they say this. The city's population, that's Jerusalem, may have increased as much as 15 times. Assyrian attacking the north, refugees pouring south, away from the war, which of course you'd expect them to do. And the city went from about 1,000 not that big, to 15,000 inhabitants at this time. They also say in their book, the population of Judah, that's the whole area, which had long hovered at a few tens of thousands, now grew to around 120,000. They worked that out, of course, from archaeological digs and density and all that kind of thing. So during the time of Isaiah, Jerusalem and Judah expanded rapidly from the north. One thing Hezekiah did was to strengthen the fortifications of the city, and he built this underground tunnel, which I've actually walked through 40 or something years ago. It's quite interesting, really, when you walk through it, because Jerusalem's water depended on an outside spring, the spring of Gihon, which was too exposed to enemy, of course. So they built underground a tunnel, and they built it from two sides, from the bottom of the hill in Jerusalem, Pool of Siloam, we know it, and from the other side as well. And amazing, really, for the day, they meet in the middle, and they only missed by a few feet, and it's a bit high there and a bit low there, but the tunnel worked for them. In fact, if you walk through it, you can see the pick going like this from one half, and from the other half you see the pick going like this. And they worked it out somehow to make this. That's one thing he did to keep the city water supply safe. He also cleansed and rededicated the temple when he saw what was happening in the north. The south never liked the north very much. Judah was always a bit maverick, was always out on its own. The bulk of the tribes were in what's called Israel, the north. And so there's a rivalry between them at many levels. So when the north was captured by the Assyrians, of course they thought, well, God's doing this, so we'll be really good and God might save us. So they did all this. They removed pagan sanctuaries from the land and regularized the cult. And that's what you're left with the destruction of and the capture of the capital Samaria, which is here. When all that area became Assyrian, conquered by the Assyrians, what you're left with in that hatched area there is the kingdom of Judah. So it was during the reign of King Hezekiah that the Assyrian army put down a revolt in the Philistine city-state of Ashdod on the coast. That was in 713. Sennacherib succeeded Sargon II in 705. The death of Sargon led to revolts in every section of the Assyrian Empire. Hezekiah seems to have played a significant role, that's the king in Judah, in organising rebellion in Palestine. He thought they could do something now that Assyria is distracted and has to go back and protect itself. He took the opportunity to try and win back some land. The prophet Isaiah ben Amoz, as we'll see tomorrow, was active in attempting to deter him from a policy which he saw as a failure to trust in Yahweh. Hezekiah went ahead, and Judah was devastated by the Assyrian army in 701. And that's the last we hear. That's when Isaiah's period of ministry ended, in about 700. However, Jerusalem itself did remain intact, but it had to pay a crippling tribute to Assyria. Sennacherib claims, and these claims have to be treated with care, so we've got this from Assyria, he claimed to have destroyed 46 fortified strongholds in Judah and to have driven 200,000 people from their cities. Well, that seems to be an exaggeration, which we can expect, but it's pretty massive. So Judah was pretty well destroyed. He besieged Jerusalem in 701, And that record of that is in the second book of Kings and in Chronicles. However, the siege was lifted, and there, within the Bible itself, there are two or three reasons given for it, so we're not exactly sure why. But Hezekiah, it seems, the most likely explanation is, with the fall of Lachish to the south of Jerusalem, Hezekiah saw, well, we've got no hope. So he sued for peace and then paid a massive tribute, which had to be paid for the rest of the time. And then the Assyrian army, anyhow, had to go back to Assyria. So we begin. Whoever put this scroll together, no doubt in post-exilic times, begin chapter 1, verse 1, with these words. The vision concerning Judah and Jerusalem that Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw during the reigns, well, they're closer to it than us, so we can take this as no doubt true, during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, who might be talking about kings of Judah. So that's his period, roughly 740 to 700. There's his name. It's made up of two words, Isaiah. One is the word for salvation, and the other is Yahweh. So Isaiah, is Yahweh, short. So, and the other is salvation. It's the same roots as the word Joshua, or Jesus, which has got it round the other way. Salvation is from Yahweh. So Isaiah chapter 1 stands alone. It is recitative, rhetorical prose that at times merits to be termed poetry. So I'm told by people who know Hebrew very well. It functions as a summary of Isaiah's key themes, and some verses may be oracles spoken at the time of Sennacherib's devastation of Judah in 701. So it's the end of Isaiah's career, if I could call it a career, that this seems to be talking to. The prophet blames all of this, the destruction of Judah and the putting the siege around the city. He blames it on the failure of justice, especially on the part of the leadership. Isaiah is particularly scathing of injustice that tries to hide behind conventional religious practice. That's very common, and it's wonderful in the prophets. They're not just concerned with injustice, which of course we must be. They're concerned with injustice that hides under two masks. One is the law, because those who control the law were sort of doing it for their own benefit, and that's not new. So he's blaming the political leadership that injustice, it sounds all right, it's actually legal what's happening, because it's according to the law, but the law itself is unjust. That's one rider. The second is cult. Everything's going well, we're all going to mass on Sunday, it's equivalent. We're all doing what we should do in a Jewish faith. So the cult is right, God's being worshipped, all of that. But underneath, there's this cancer of injustice. Chapter 1, verse 2. Hear, O heavens, listen, O earth, Yahweh is speaking. So you need two witnesses for a word to be accepted in law as true. He's calling, the two witnesses he's calling on are the whole of the heavens, which witness everything, and the whole of the earth. Couldn't get two more powerful witnesses. Heaven and earth have witnessed the whole of history. They're in the best position to witness Israel's extraordinary obtuseness, which involves, as we'll see, looking to false gods, entering foolishly into political alliances that involve them in religious compromise, and rejecting God's word mediated through the prophets. And the text, I've got the text in red, I guess you've worked that out. This is actually Isaiah, and this is God speaking as Isaiah feels it, experiences it in his communion with God. That's Yahweh, I reared children and brought them up, but they've rebelled against me. The ox knows its owner. The donkey, its master's crib. But Israel doesn't know. My people do not understand. Know is a beautiful word in Hebrew. It's not knowing about. It's not information. Nothing wrong with that, of course. It's knowing through intimacy, knowing through communion, knowing the only way when you really know from, I guess, love, finally. So he is God. The ox knows the owner, for God's sake. What's up with you people? Israel doesn't know. My people do not understand. The book of Deuteronomy, on a similar theme, says, you forgot the God who gave you birth. That theme, and I'll now look at Hosea, worked about, or he's in the north, Hosea, and he's writing at the time of Isaiah in the south. And he has this to say, and it's very probable, if at least probable, that the Hosea scroll and the Amos scroll, and they're the only two prophetic scrolls we have from the northern kingdom, they came south with the refugees. Did Isaiah read them? Well, probably. But this is what Hosea had to say, and it links in, it's a similar. When Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt I called my son. The more I called them, the more they went from me, says God, as Hosea understood it. They kept sacrificing to the Baals, to the stock exchange, to the market forces. You put your own words in there. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and offering incense to idols. Yet it was I, says God, who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them in my arms, but they didn't know that it was I who healed them. I led them with cords of human kindness, with bands of love. I was to them like those who lift an infant to the cheek. I bent down and I fed them. Beautiful images of God. Back to Isaiah, chapter 1, verse 4. Ah, sinful nation, people laden with iniquity, offspring who do evil, children who deal corruptly, who have forsaken the Lord, who've despised the Holy One of Israel, who are utterly estranged. Why do you seek further beatings? There's all this chaos happening around. Why do you continue to rebel? The whole head is sick, the heart is faint. From the sole of the feet even to the head, there is no soundness in it, but bruises, sores, and bleeding wounds. They've not been drained or bound up or softened with oil. The country's bleeding to death. Your country lies desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. In your very presence, aliens devour your land. It's desolate, overgrown by foreigners. And daughter Zion, that's Jerusalem, is left like a booth in a vineyard, like a shelter in a cucumber field, like a besieged city. If the Lord of hosts hadn't left us a few survivors, we would have been like Sodom and become like Gomorrah. We've all got it. Everyone has to read that and take it on board. But I hope it helps to know that that's written as the Assyrians are destroying Judah all around and surrounding the city. It's all that's left. And he goes on, what to me is the multitude of your sacrifices. What's the point of all this cult worshipping me when you're not? I've had enough of burnt offerings of rams and the suet of fattened beasts. I don't delight in the blood of bulls or lambs or goats, says God. When you come to appear before me, who asked this from your hand? Trample my courts no more, bringing offerings is futile. Incense is an abomination to me. New moon and Sabbath, calling on convocation. I cannot endure solemn assemblies with iniquity. This is not actually against the cult. It's against the cult while all this injustice is going on. Your new moons and your appointed festivals, my soul hates. They've become a burden to me. I'm weary of bearing them. God's appeal to the people through this wonderful Isaiah ben Amos. Similar material coming from the northern kingdom, a bit before Isaiah, from Amos. God speaking through that prophet. I hate, I despise your festivals. I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and grain offerings, I won't accept them. And the offerings of well-being of your fattened animals, I won't look upon them. Take away from me the noise of your songs. I won't listen to the melody of your harps. This is what God wants, according to Amos. Surely he's right. Let justice flow down like waters, and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. And of course, if that's happening, then by all means blow the bugles and have the ceremonies and carry the statues through the land. All the rest of it follows. But if this is not happening, it's abhorrent. That's Amos, but Isaiah has said the same thing. Micah, a contemporary of Isaiah in Jerusalem. So these two are both there, helping each other primarily. This is Micah. He says, God says through him, with what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, calves, a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams and 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, which the Moabites were doing and the Ammonites, killing their firstborn son for the angry gods and letting the blood pour down into the ground to assuage the anger of their gods? Dreadful stuff happening in the name of religion. Well, it looks like some of the people of Judah are doing the same. When we're afraid, we get primitive and we'll do anything to get the gods on side. Well, Micah's saying, he's told you what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? Do justice. Don't just talk about it. Do it. Love kindness. Commit yourself to being kind and walk humbly with your God. Back to Isaiah now, chapter 1 still, verse 15. When you stretch out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you, says God. Even though you make many prayers, I won't listen, because your hands are full of blood. Wash yourself. Make yourselves clean. Remove the evil of your doings from before my eyes. Cease to do evil and learn to do good. Seek justice. Rescue the oppressed. defend the orphan, plead for the widow. We can imagine Jesus reading this as a boy and thinking, wow, and getting caught up in it all beautifully. Well, here's Jesus' words, Matthew 23. Woe to you. And when Jesus says, woe to you, please don't imagine he's kind of threatening them. He's crying as he says it. He's just saying, look, it's hopeless. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You're paying tithes of mint and dill and cumin, and you've neglected the weightier things of the law, right judgment, mercy, and fidelity. Isaiah, come now, let's argue it out, says Yahweh. Though your sins are like scarlet, they could be like snow. Though they are red like crimson, they could become like wool. And here's the first problem of interpretation. The Hebrew text, as with the Greek text of the New Testament and the Old Testament, they had no punctuation. Hebrew didn't, in a sense, need it a lot because, unlike our language, they don't even need vowels. You can read it without it, with sometimes a bit of hesitation, but the context will always clarify it. It seems to me, it was certainly likely, I think it's probable, that that's actually a question, not a statement. And if it's a question, this is how you translate it. If your sins are like scarlet, do you think they'll be like snow? If they are red like crimson, do you think they'll be like wool? Like, who are you trying to kid? You're not trying to kid God, because God's not kiddable. Okay, if this is what they're really like, why do you think it's going to be okay? And God's going to say, aren't you marvellous? No, it won't be like that. Verse 27, Zion shall be redeemed. Brackets, Australia shall be redeemed. Zion shall be redeemed by justice. And those in her who repent by righteousness. Good word in English, righteousness. Not easy, but I'll just show you. It's made up of two words. Right is obvious. The next bit's not at all obvious. It's actually the word wise. It's collapsed, as words do. Righteousness means right wiseness. Wise as to what is right. And what is right is not sinning like scarlet and crimson and offering ceremonies to God while you don't care about justice. That's chapter 1. Of Isaiah seems to be chosen as chapter 1 by the editors of the final scroll, because that's what we've got, and put up front because it absolutely beautifully picks up Isaiah's central themes and it really sums up his ministry. Chapter 2 of the scroll begins like this, and it looks like this is actually the introduction to the scroll before one was put on. It reads, the word Isaiah, son of Amos, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. Clearly a beginning, an editorial note starting off the prophecy. But someone else later thought, no, we can do better than that. So they put in Isaiah chapter 1. The central core, and this is for the rest of this morning what I'll be doing with you, the central core of chapter 2, verse 5, to chapter 4, verse 1, threatens judgment. It's introduced by words that appear to be composed after the judgment has come, probably after the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 and the exile in Babylon. And in circumstances, namely the return to Judah, that open up a new perspective on the future. It concludes in a similar way. The post-exilic editors have thus bracketed Isaiah's words in such a way as to challenge their contemporaries in 400 and something, 250 years after the time of Isaiah. They've bracketed Isaiah's words in such a way as to challenge their contemporaries to learn from the mistakes of the past, but also to take up the mission to the world that Yahweh has given them by bringing them back to Judah and rebuilding the temple. I don't want to delay on that. There's a fair bit said in there, and we're dealing with probabilities here, not certainties. Let's go to the text. Chapter 2, verse 1. This text is actually found also in the prophecy of Micah, who was a contemporary of Isaiah. So what are we dealing with? Scholars aren't certain, but it's likely that we've got a piece that no one quite knew. They knew it came from this period, so just to make sure everything's right, they put it in Isaiah and they put it in Micah, in case one or other of them, whoever it was, said it. This is how it reads. In days to come, the mountain of Yahweh's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be raised above the hills. All nations will stream to it. They've been to Babylon and they've come back. And here they are. All the nations have streamed to it. Many peoples shall come and say, come, let's go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways and we may walk in his paths. Bracket. Abraham was said he'd be the father of many nations. These returned exiles, still reading Isaiah, etc., have covered all that. They're seeing that the whole world is going to come to Jerusalem and worship one God. That's their dream. And by the way, it was the Christian Jews who picked up that dream and enabled the Catholic Universal Church to carry on the message of Jesus to the whole world. Many people will come and say, let's go up to the mountain, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways and we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the Torah, and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and arbitrate for many peoples. They'll beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. Before the release of South Africa.
Mandela,
thank you. So blank and senior moment. Before the release of Mandela, I only found this out recently, de Klerk, who without him the peaceful transition wouldn't have happened, they destroyed their atomic weapons. Because he wanted it to be a powerful sign that they wanted, even though they didn't know how are we going to get peace after all this apartheid? How are we going to do it? Well, one of his gestures was to destroy their atomic, five or six atomic bombs they had prepared. I've never checked that, but that's what I was told happened. If it's true, was de Klerk reading this passage perhaps? How do people come to heroic things? The kind of heroic things that we now, looking back, wish had have happened at 9/11. If America had got on its knees instead of doing what it did, and realise what's going wrong with us, that these nations of the world are so angry with us. Could they have learnt a lesson there? If you, I don't know, of course. But this is a dream here. Isaiah chapter 2, beginning of the chapter. There's got to be a way that's different from power, power, and cycles of violence. From Isaiah's early period of ministry during the regency of Jotham, this part comes now, chapter 2, prior to Uzziah's death. The contrast between the passage we just read about plowshares, etc., and the rest of chapter 2 couldn't be more striking. It's been prepared for later by that beautiful piece, but here's the Isaiah material. We've heard that the mountains of Yahweh's house will be exalted. Now we're told that the mountains of human arrogance will be brought down. We've heard that the nations will flow to Yahweh's mountain to learn of God and to walk in God's ways. Now we're going to read that Jerusalem is full of foreigners and soothsayers worshipping their own inventions. We've heard in the early verses, we've heard that the nations will reject weapons of violence. And now we're told that the rulers of Jerusalem are pursuing trade in horses and chariots, the tanks of the day. We've heard that peace and harmony will be the result of Yahweh's reign. And now we're going to be told of the terror, fear, and humiliation that's rife in Judah. To prepare us for this powerful and frightening material, somebody put that lovely hope to keep us not despairing. Now let's read it, Isaiah. It's made up of exhortations and descriptions. O house of Jacob, come, let us walk into Yahweh's light. The translations I have read in. Could be, but I think it's into. In other words, they're not in the light, but they can walk into it. You have forsaken your people, O house of Jacob. House of Jacob means ruling authority. The rulers, the political leaders, as in many countries, are a key to the problem. So he's saying to the leaders, you've forsaken your own people. And then a description. Indeed, they are full of diviners from the east and soothsayers like the Philistines. They clasp hands with foreigners. Their land is filled with silver and gold, and there's no end to their treasures. Their land is filled with horses. They didn't use horses for races, they used them for military purposes. And there's no end to their chariots. Their land is filled with idols. They bow down to the work of their hands, to what their own fingers have made. And so people are humbled and everyone is dragged down. And my small comment. Prosperity has brought in its train the worship of idols. Instead of fidelity to the covenant with its demands of care for one's neighbour, self-interest has the rich bowing down to the work of their own hands, with the consequence that everyone is dragged down. Another exhortation. Don't raise your eyes to them, to your leaders following them. Go to the rock. Stay hidden in the dust, in terror of Yahweh, of the glory of his majesty. And then the judgment. The haughtiness of people will be humbled. The pride of everyone will be brought low. Yahweh alone will be exalted on that day. For Yahweh of hosts has a day against all that is proud and lofty. In the Hebrew setting, the day of Yahweh was always looked forward to with joy, because the day of Yahweh will be the day when Yahweh, their God, shows that they are God. God's chosen, and their enemies will all be destroyed. It's a positive thing. The prophets keep twisting it and saying, no. The day of Yahweh will be the day when you come under judgment. Here it is. Yahweh has a day against all that's proud and lofty, against all that's lifted up and high, against all the cedars of Lebanon, lofty and lifted up, and against all the oaks of Bashan, against all the high mountains, against all the lofty hills, against every high tower. And you've got to put in there, and cruiser, and what are the big ones that carry planes? Ships, aircraft carriers, etc. And against every fortified wall, against all the ships of Tarshish. These are the ships that can take in the Mediterranean, can go into the open sea. Most of them just had to cling to the land, just do small trips. The ships of Tarshish are the ones that can go right out and manage with the storms. And against all the beautiful craft. And then the theme comes in again. The haughtiness of people will be humbled. The pride of everyone will be brought low. Yahweh alone will be exalted on that day. Yahweh alone, not Judah and its leaders, etc. This all should be put to music, but I don't know how to do that, so. The idols shall utterly pass away. They'll go into the caves in the rocks and into holes in the earth in terror of Yahweh and of the glory of his majesty when he rises to cause the earth to quake. On that day, people will throw away to the moles and the bats their idols of silver and their idols of gold, which they've made for themselves to worship. They'll go into the caves of the rocks and into holes in the earth in terror of Yahweh. Yahweh, in other words, cares about justice and will bring it. That's how they understood Yahweh. And the glory of his majesty when he rises to cause the earth to quake. Exhortation again. Turn away from sin, says the prophet, in whose nostrils is breath for what it's worth. For now, the sovereign Yahweh of hosts is taking away from Jerusalem and from Judah support and staff, warrior and soldier, judge and prophet, diviner and elder, captain of 50, dignitary, counselor, and skillful magician, and expert enchanter. Isaiah's not making too many friends with all this stuff, but that's what he's saying. And I will make boys their princes, and babes will rule over them. The people will be oppressed one by another, and everyone by a neighbour. The youth will be insolent to the elder, and the base to the honourable. Someone will even seize a relative, a member of the clan, saying, "You have a cloak, you'll be our leader, and this heap of ruins will be under your rule." But the other will cry out on that day and say, "I won't be a healer. In my house there's neither bread nor cloak. You shall not make me leader of the people." No one wants to govern. For Jerusalem has stumbled. Judah has fallen. Because their speech and their deeds are against Yahweh. Yahweh is the Lord of the burning bush, the God of justice. The Redeemer God, the Liberator God, not the Oppressor God. Jerusalem has stumbled because their speech and their deeds are against Yahweh, defying his glorious presence. The look on their faces bears witness against them. They proclaim their sin like Sodom. They don't hide it. Woe to them. They have brought evil on themselves. And the text continues, "Say this, how good things are for the just, for he will feed on the fruit of his deeds. Woe to the unjust, it will go ill with him. He will be treated as his actions deserve." And the third description, "O my people, your leaders mislead you and confuse the course of your paths. Yahweh rises to argue his cause. He stands to judge the peoples. Yahweh enters into judgment with the elders and the princes of his people. It's you who have devoured the vineyard. The spoil of the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people? By grinding the face of the poor? He's not attacking the Assyrians, he's attacking the wealthy and powerful in Judah. Then comes the following statement, and I suggest to you without certainty, because we're dealing with poetry here, the daughters of Jerusalem are the towns around about. And he's not particularly talking about women, he's talking about the big city and then its daughters. See what you think when I read it to you. Yahweh said, because the daughters of Zion are haughty and walk with outstretched necks, glancing wantonly with their eyes, mincing along as they go, tinkling with their feet. So he's using the imagery, of course. The Lord will afflict with scabs the heads of the daughters of Zion, and Yahweh will lay bare their secret parts. In that day the Lord will take away the finery of the anklets, the headbands, the crescents, the pendants, the bracelets, the scarfs, the headdresses, the armlets, the sashes, the perfume boxes, and the amulets, the signet rings and nose rings. It gives you an idea of how the rich women dressed the day. But he's using this imagery to talk about the wealthy few in the surrounding cities that are bringing on this dreadful stuff. Their festal robes, the mantles, the cloaks, the handbags, nothing much has changed. The garments of gauze and linen garments and turbans and veils. How are we all going? You got one of each of those at home? And now, instead of perfume, there'll be a stench. Instead of a sash that these rich leaders are enjoying, no. Instead of a sash, there'll be a rope. Instead of well-set hair, baldness. Instead of a rich robe, a binding of sackcloth. Instead of beauty, shame. Your men will fall by the sword, and your warriors in battle. Hence my suggestion that you of these neighbouring cities around Jerusalem. Your men will fall by the sword, your warriors in battle. Her gates shall lament and mourn. Ravaged, she shall sit upon the ground. Seven women shall take hold of one man in that day, because of the death of the warriors, saying, we'll eat our own bread and wear our own clothes. Just let us be called by your name. I want a man to give them protection and whatever. Take away our disgrace. I've just got two more slides for you, introducing now the last verses of chapter 4. Like the beginning verses of chapter 2, which I've read with you, this is written from a post-exilic perspective. Years later, Isaiah's dire warnings, in fact, went unheeded. Jerusalem was destroyed. Its leading citizens were carted off into Babylon. That's the fact. With Babylon's capitulation to Cyrus of Persia, a remnant did return to Judah to rebuild the city and the temple. The worst is over. The shadows of the past hangs over them. Its lessons mustn't be forgotten. But Yahweh's fidelity to his people has opened up for them a new future. because of the obvious political weakness of Judah, now part of the western province of a vast Persian empire, those who wanted to inspire hope for a glorious future, they couldn't look to Judah and the king, because there's no king and it's a landlocked little nation. No, they started to look towards God to solve their problems. Yahweh's intervention. The way they understood Yahweh to have intervened to miraculously restore them to Judah against all odds. And the final words of chapter 4, another oracle of salvation before and after that powerful judgmental material. On that day, the shoot, and I just alert you there that in the Aramaic Targum, that's the translation of the Hebrew into Aramaic, they actually put the word Mashiach there, Messiah. On that day, the Messiah that Yahweh has planted shall be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land shall be pride and glory of the survivors of Israel. Whoever is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy. Everyone who's been recorded for life in Jerusalem, once the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and cleansed the bloodstains of Jerusalem from its midst by a spirit of judgment and a spirit of burning, then Yahweh will create over the whole site of Mount Zion and over its places of assembly a cloud by day and smoke and the shining of a flaming fire by night. And you know where that comes from, the Exodus story. God will guide us, guide them. Indeed, over all the glory there will be a canopy. It will serve as a pavilion, a shade by day from the heat, and a refuge and a shelter from the storm and rain. So this morning I've introduced you to the first four chapters of the Isaiah scroll. Most of it coming, the first part from the prophet himself, the end of his long career ministry. The rest of it earlier on, but very judgmental, trying to get people to change. And then those two beautiful salvation oracles put in later when hope had started to rebuild itself after the return.